The reason I started the Church of the Healing Spirit was so I could talk about healing, and I could talk about Christ in the context of healing rather than in terms of his execution and any other aspect of that, although I'm pretty thrilled with the idea of his miracles. I like that too. But sometimes when you're talking about healing, you do have to put your attention on the problems that interfere with healing. And if you think that healing is divinely designed, as I do, and as is pretty obvious when you think about it, it pays sometimes to notice what problems are actually interfering with it. Which brings me to today's topic, the problems with beliefs and harmony. Most, if not all, disharmony seems to be due to things not being the way we want them to be. We have beliefs, we have rules, we have fears, we have expectations, we have desires, we have wants, all kinds of things that define for us how life should be and also how other people should behave and how they should do things and how they should think and so on. When life doesn't follow our beliefs or other people don't follow our beliefs, we become disharmonious. To say that another way, we become angry, we become sad, we become afraid, we become vindictive. We become a lot of different versions of disharmonious. It's funny in a weird, not a ha-ha way, but in a weird sort of way that our beliefs are often built around how others should be and do and have, and maybe not so much about the responsibility for ourselves and the way we should be or do or have, which leads us to stake our happiness and our harmony on our ability to control other people. It's almost as if we say, I have my power and responsibility to be happy, and then we give it to somebody else, and then we watch their behavior and go, they misbehaved, and now I'm unhappy. Trying to control other people is not really going to work. Anybody who's been a parent, or anybody who's been a kid and has had parents, pretty much knows human beings are uncontrollable. And the problem is even made worse by the fact that we invest very little time and effort in controlling ourselves. Ultimately, when it comes down to it, I believe that the only effective control is self-control. But that's not really what's marketed very much. Obedience is much more marketed, which is to obey somebody else's control, of course. If we notice how we interpret what is, you know, the current state of circumstances, and then we compare it to what we believe it should be, it's the gap, it's the discrepancy between what is and how it should be, in our own estimation. That's what we're reacting to. That discrepancy is what we're reacting to. And it's very easy to feel threatened when we notice this discrepancy. And as soon as we process it as a threat, we have no choice but to physiologically be tricked into going into fight or flight. Two notorious areas where this discrepancy between beliefs that show up all the time are beliefs about religion and beliefs about politics. We believe people should believe what we believe. That's simple enough. Except they, on the other hand, believe we should believe what they believe. Okay, obviously we've got a problem here. And as we try to enforce our beliefs on them, and while they're doing the same thing, trying to enforce their beliefs on us, there's an increase in disharmony. Disharmony is not love. Disharmony is not hyphen love. It's not love. That other thing that we should be working at, it is not that. The part about beliefs that most people overlook is that beliefs are just beliefs. Beliefs are thoughts that are thought over and over and over until we practice them so much we believe them be true. Hey, that my belief is true. Why? Because I thought it a whole bunch of times? Just because we believe something does not make it true or accurate or useful or valuable. However, beliefs are powerful. If you thought of it like this, they're basically like strong, weight-bearing structures in a building, right? If you want to remodel a building, you have to look at a wall. Is that a load-bearing wall? Is that a load-bearing wall? Is that a load-bearing wall? Because you can't take those things down without doing all kinds of other things in order to compensate for it. But beliefs are like load-bearing structures in how we be, how we do, how we build our own lives. And that's why when somebody challenges a religious belief or a political belief or maybe other beliefs in other contexts, we react like we're threatened. Oh, my belief is load-bearing. That's what I base my identity on. My individuality is resting on that particular belief, which somebody made up and handed it to me and I accepted it. But you're scaring me by challenging it. When you really look at your life, our beliefs serve as the ceilings and the roofs, which determine how high we can go in life. It's like, yeah. And if you think about the beliefs as like floors, you go, now I know how I can't descend beyond this particular level. My beliefs will not let me get worse than this, and my beliefs will not let me get better than this. Okay, now you basically have self-contained using beliefs as the top and the bottom of us. And if we think in terms of walls as the how wide our influence in the world can be, or what we can do, the amount of good we can contribute, our beliefs limit the width of that. It's like, beliefs determine our place in the world and the space, that is, our energetic, harmonious footprint that we can use to contribute to the well-being in the world. Beliefs determine what we will be, do, and have. A lot of people put a tremendous amount of energy into being more and doing more and having more and having more and having more and doing more and doing more. It's like, if you went back in time and changed your beliefs, all of the being, doing, and having would be so much easier and harmonious. If you think of this, beliefs are like the boundaries of our force field. They're like the edge. You know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, they talked about comfort zones. Oh, you got to expand your comfort zone. But if you drew a circle around a stick figure and say, that's my comfort zone, what is the circle? What is that edge? Those are beliefs. What are they doing? Well, presumably, they're protecting us. They're protecting us from criticism, emotional, or physical attack. And you've heard those things before as the first driving need of the ego that is represented and being expressed through the personality. So our beliefs are like, I need this protection. That's cool. And you can see that, you know what? Beliefs, according to that design, they're kind of like a virtual or an energetic immune system filtering in environmental signals and also filtering out ones that are, it doesn't fit my beliefs, doesn't fit what I want, things that I'm afraid of. I have to reject those things. I have to filter them out. Our beliefs enable or disallow certain environmental signals to penetrate our consciousness. It's like, yikes. But it makes perfect sense. If you were to take a person who had experienced abuse as a child, and then you heard or were told or you watched a demonstration of this person's behavior, and you saw that person, they tend to interpret environmental signals as potentially threatening much more than you or much more than me or much more than a person who had never experienced abuse in childhood. And you go, well, that makes perfect sense. If you've experienced threats, you can become sensitized to threats. And when you look at it, beliefs about disharmony, another way of saying threats, or disharmony, saying that's another way of describing things I do not want or I do not like, or, frankly, which is pretty common, things I do not understand. So, because I don't understand it, I have to consider it a threat. How about getting some understanding? That's not often considered. But when you think a person says, hey, I'm experiencing or I'm believing in or I'm sensing disharmony, you can count on there will be some sort of impulse that will drive them toward action to try to resolve that disharmony. Right? You don't have enough air in one of your tires. Guess what you're going to do? You are not going to let air out of the other three tires so they're equal. You're going to try to get air into the tire that needs it. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. But oftentimes, the complications get worse when the actions are not effective at dealing with the disharmony. Compensating for the disharmony is not the same thing as creating harmony. Putting air in the tire is not necessarily resolving the problem. It is changing the state, and maybe it's a problem. I had this experience when Marianne and I were driving home from New York in the past summer. All of a sudden, the indicator on the dashboard indicated that one of my tires was losing air. I said, yikes. And I pulled into the gas station. One tire was losing air. Filled it up to the proper level and resumed driving. About 15 miles or so later, the tire was losing air again. I had to pull into a gas station. Had to do this about 8 or 9, it seemed, times on the way back to Naples, Florida. I was compensating for it, for sure, but the resolution of it didn't happen until the next day when the car went into the dealership and you had a nail in your tire, Tom. So what's the solution here? Well, we can compensate by trying to patch the hole after we remove the nail. Okay. And a week or so later, when that did not work, we solved the problem by replacing that tire. It's like, So compensating for disharmony is not the same thing as creating harmony. You know why? Because most compensating actions are really designed to remove awareness of the problem, not to increase awareness of the solution. Guess what I wanted when I was putting air in the tire? I wanted the light on my dashboard not to show up saying, your tire has air deficiency. I didn't want to see that. I used to live in New York City for years and years, and I'd take the taxis periodically, although I preferred the subways and occasionally the buses. But I'm in a taxi, and I would notice there was a piece of masking tape over the change oil light. So I'd say to the taxi driver, what's up with that? What's the masking tape for? He said, we don't change the oil in taxis. All we do is add new oil. You don't change the oil in a taxi? No. Economically, it's not profitable for the owner of the cab. So we just add oil whenever the oil is low. So how many miles are you going to drive this car? He said, this car will be junked when it's about 300,000 miles. This car is going to be driven 300,000 miles, and you compensate for that red light by putting a masking tape over it on the dashboard and never changing the oil and just adding oil. So that's exactly right. And it will go into the junkyard. Okay, that's interesting. So this idea about removing awareness of the problem is not limited to taxi drivers and taxi cab companies in New York City. Think about pain pills. It's like, I have pain. Here, take this pill. Oh, the pain went away. No, it didn't. What did it do? It masked your awareness. You're no longer aware of the problem. You do have the problem. You know, the pain is still there. You just can't recognize it. You no longer notice it. We modified your awareness. In other words, we made you less aware of the pain that your body is experiencing. Is that a good thing? Well, sometimes in terrible circumstances, burn victims and so on, need to keep these people sedated so they can rest. Rest is an incredibly important part of healing. And if a person is so in so much pain that they cannot rest, cannot sleep, healing is either interfered with or prevented entirely. So there is a situation where blocking awareness of a problem really can serve us. I see all the stuff going on, maybe this is a problem of mine, on the planet in terms of war and threats and dangers, particularly with regard to the political situation in the United States and the Mideast. And it occurs to me that most of the conflicts on this planet have the clash of beliefs as a major aspect. We give power to our beliefs, like they're sacred, and then we diminish other people's beliefs. And of course, hey, now, because of that discrepancy, we're more superior, we're better, we're holier, we're more righteous. This justifies our actions. And sometimes our actions are unspeakably heinous actions. Hitler, he had his beliefs. America, pursuing oil reserves in Iraq because we believe that, hey, our survival depends on having access to petroleum products. And so how do you get that? Well, we got to go into other people's countries and we'll take their resources. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yep. And we took those actions, and those actions have resulted in horrific loss of life and destruction. It's like, yeah, okay. Maybe those two disharmonies, Hitler and the United States activities, could be phrased differently. How about, Hitler believed there were too many Jews, too many gypsies, too many Catholics, and to remedy this disharmony, let's exterminate them. Okay. America believed there was a lot of oil in Iraq's soil, and we believe it has to be in American oil company control. And to remedy this discrepancy, we started a war under false pretenses. Simple enough. We believe in threats, and threats are easily translated into disharmony. What people don't understand is the concept, and a lot of people seem not to understand the concept of consciousness. They believe the threats that are outside of us are really the cause of our problems, rather than their own perceptions. Bruce Lipton would disagree with that. He would say, no, perceptions. That's really where we have a great opportunity to improve our own lives. We can learn that feeling threatened is about us, about our perceptions, and about our consciousness. And not so much about the perceived person or religion or the country or the language or the color of that other person or thing. Threats are vibrational patterns within our own consciousness that get triggered by certain resonant vibrational signals coming to us. And it's like, oop, I'm activated. I'm all stimulated. I'm all angry. I'm all righteous. I'm all homicidal. How did that happen? What triggered that guy? Well, first of all, he would have to have that stuff in his consciousness in order to get like that. And where does that happen? How does that go? Where does that come from? Well, in America, of course, with television spewing violence at unbelievable levels, to turn around and find people who are violent, have tremendous impulses toward that, toward disharmony. Really, no surprise. And it's further complicated because living beings are designed to perceive threats. There's a real high survival value to that awareness, right? And the bloodline that was in a cave and heard growling and was curious and went out to see what it was and didn't perceive it as a threat, they don't have descendants on planet Earth because they ended up on a menu of some critter. So perceiving a threat, good idea, except we don't want to accumulate and continually access an inventory of threats from our entire lifespan. And then if you add in our ancestors, so you've got generations of perceived threats. And you go, wow, that's an enormous inventory. It's kind of like what's threatening to a four-year-old child. And it's like, and that's still valid today, even though I'm, 40-year-old woman or 40-year-old man or an 80-year-old woman or an 80-year-old man, we're still using a 4-year-old perception of what a threat is and physiologically reacting to it? Whoa, that cannot be a good thing. While it's really common to see or read about humans waging war to obliterate threats, it's less common to hear about humans elevating their consciousnesses in relation to the threats, and thereby reducing the disharmony in themselves and the threats. I think one of the most surprising aspects of is this human tendency to fight threats. Right? War on this and war on that. Terror, drugs, cancer, on and on. That's a threat. We got to fight it. It's like, we know from experience, we know that creating harmony between us and the threat, however we label it, is ultimately the only course of action that is workable. But we still fight. Somebody yells, oh, we got to go fight. And everybody jumps up and turns into a mob. And it's like, that doesn't work. Oh, yeah. I got caught up in my ego thing, and yeah. Mm-hmm. We're an amazing species. We could just take one moment and think, you know what? Two people singing in harmony, or two people dancing in harmony, or two people rowing a boat in the same direction in harmony, or people working in harmony, are more effective and happier and healthier than those people who are in conflict and acting disharmoniously. Very few people, no matter what their religious or political beliefs, are going to disagree with that statement. With that thought in mind, though, it makes me wonder why harmony isn't taught. Why isn't there more emphasis on harmony? Why isn't harmony the dominant impulse taught to children early on to guide their behaviors? Let's bring in the ego. Competition, right? Competition. Kids at very early ages are taught that. The ego is not driven to achieve harmony with other people or things. In fact, it's just the opposite. The ego is devoted to protecting and asserting the individuality. It has really little regard for the individuality of other people or things. You probably have experienced this, but imagine it. That the disharmony that you could feel being with another person who has no regard for you or your importance as a person. If you've been in more than one relationship in your lifetime, you probably have had that experience. And you go, that's right. And it was not much fun. I saw an upsetting headline just this morning, actually, that a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, has the belief that we in the U.S. should bomb Iran. I haven't read his whole opinion in the New York Times, but I'm guessing he does not provide estimates of the number of children, the number of women, or the number of men that would be killed in his desired bombings. He probably doesn't even estimate the damage to Iranian infrastructure in terms of what it's going to do to quality of life, how it will increase suffering, and what it will cost to repair, if it could ever be done. And I know this for a fact. He clearly doesn't understand that we in the U.S. would reap what we sow. People that don't understand the law of cause and effect put a lot of people at risk. If our bombing were to occur, we could certainly expect our enemies, the old ones and the new ones that we just made through that action, to be hell-bent on reciprocating with bombing the U.S. Our enemies would believe that they're doing the right thing in trying to destroy the U.S. So, which destroyer would be right? The John Boltons of the world or the reciprocators? Which destroyer would believe he's right? And which destroyer would actually be creating harmony in the world? Neither would be right. But both would believe they were right. And certainly, neither would be increasing harmony on planet Earth. It ought to be pretty clear in that example that following beliefs with an imagined path to harmony may be a terrible idea. Kill, let's kill for harmony. You sure? Yeah, I believe that'll work. Yeah, that may be a terrible idea. If we were to take the law of cause and effect into consideration and consider, let's don't follow our beliefs. Let's take the path to harmony. This action, I believe, which of course could be very ego-driven and fear-driven, a decision made in fear is not going to be a high vibration decision. A decision made by ego is not going to be a high vibration decision. We're better than that. So if we use that, we're at the fork in the road. I'm going to do what my beliefs tell me to do, or this other path is marked harmony. Yeah, and if I consider the law of cause and effect, I think that decision becomes clearer and easier to make. Harmony trumps beliefs. Love trumps beliefs. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know that you are perfectly receptive of us, but you are universal, loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.